You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and thank you for joining the American Revolution. This week, episode 304, the Jacksonboro Assembly. For the last couple of weeks, we've been covering the continued fighting in South Carolina following the British surrender at Yorktown in late 1781. While all that fighting continued, the Patriots were also making an effort to restore civilian rule in South Carolina and Georgia. With the British restricted to Charleston, where Navy cannons could support the garrison, the remainder of South Carolina was largely in Patriot hands by late 1781. Governor Rutledge returned to the state to begin the process of reestablishing normal government functions. Rutledge had been the civilian leader in South Carolina for almost the entire Revolution. Before the war, Rutledge had been a lawyer and a state legislator in the colonial government. He had been a longtime foe of British taxation efforts, serving as far back as the Stamp Act Congress in 1765. He also served as a delegate at the First and Second Continental Congresses, and in early 1776, he left Congress to become the first president of South Carolina, before Congress even approved the Declaration of Independence. While Rutledge was a proponent of an independent South Carolina, he was not necessarily a big fan of democracy. In 1778, Rutledge vetoed a new constitution that he deemed too democratic. When the legislature overrode his veto, he resigned from office. The following year, the British captured Georgia and threatened to take South Carolina. At that point, the new governor of South Carolina resigned, and the legislature called upon Rutledge to once again take up the governorship. They granted him considerable power to do whatever was necessary to protect the state from the British. When the British did invade in 1780, Rutledge had to flee to North Carolina to avoid capture. He continued to operate a government in exile, operating out of Hillsborough. He spent much of his time in Philadelphia trying to get the Continental Congress to provide more military support for the state. In his role as commander-in-chief of the South Carolina military, Rutledge appointed military leaders within the state, granting generalships to Sumter, Marion, and Pickens, as well as lots of lesser officer commissions. For much of 1780 and 81, Rutledge acted with what we would call dictatorial powers. He didn't have a legislature in session to perform the normal functions of government, but as the British military threat withdrew from most of the state in late 1781, Rutledge decided it was time to return to civil government. The first step in restoring government was to call for a new statewide election for the General Assembly. Given the state of the war in South Carolina, the election was difficult. On November 23rd, the governor issued writs of election to his militia generals, calling on them to distribute them through the various militia districts. The elections were scheduled for December 17th and 18th. Details on the elections themselves are pretty scarce. The 1778 Constitution limited the vote to free white men who professed a belief in God, who were at least 21 years old, and who owned at least 50 acres of land, among a few other restrictions. There were also no private ballots in the 18th century, so men had to declare their votes publicly in front of everyone. Loyalists were not allowed to vote in this election, and it appears the military was in charge of the elections in many places. Whatever the limitations, the elections marked a return to civilian government after 2 years without any legislature at all. Many of those elected were also military leaders. Generals Sumter and Marion both became senators, as did Colonels Hugh Ory, Thomas Taylor, and William Thompson. General Pickens was elected to the House, as was Continental Colonel John Laurens. The governor's brother, Hugh Rutledge, was elected Speaker of the House. Since the British still occupied the capital at Charleston, the legislature originally planned to meet in Camden. General Nathaniel Greene, however, encouraged the governor to meet in Jacksonboro instead. Camden, Greene argued, was too far away from the army and might be subject to a loyalist raid, as had happened in North Carolina recently when the governor there was kidnapped by loyalist soldiers. The ability to get food and supplies in Camden was also much more limited. Jacksonboro was much closer to Charleston, only about 35 miles inland. At one point, Greene got word that 3,000 British troops were going to land at Charleston and begin a new offensive. So at this point, Greene changed his mind and said that perhaps Camden would be a better option after all. By that time, though, it was too late to get the word out to all the delegates, so they stuck with Jacksonboro. In the end, the rumor of British troop landings proved false, so there was no threat to the assembly. The first major obstacle the assembly faced, though, was getting enough delegates to show up to form a quorum. Although the assembly was scheduled for its first meeting on January 8, 1782, it didn't have enough members to do any business until January 17th. The day after they got their quorum, Governor Rutledge addressed the assembly. He focused on the British depredations on the people of South Carolina and praised the actions of General Greene and the Continental Army in combating the British occupation. He also praised the South Carolina militia under Sumter and Marion, and at the same time he attacked the actions of the Loyalists in assisting the British against their friends and neighbors. The assembly generally approved of the speech. Nevertheless, one of their first actions was to replace Governor Rutledge. This was nothing personal. The Constitution of 1778 allowed a governor to serve for only 2 out of every 6 years. Rutledge had already served for 2 years. After some debate, the assembly elected John Matthews as the new governor. Matthews had been a militia officer, but primarily served in civil offices. He had served in the assembly in the past and as a judge earlier in the war. He was also a former speaker of the assembly. Before getting elected to the most recent assembly, Matthews had been serving as a South Carolina delegate at the Continental Congress in Philadelphia. With that out of the way, the legislative session focused primarily on how to continue financing the war. Much of the debate centered around what to do with the property of loyalists. A great many estates had already been seized. The assembly made that official for many, listing several hundred loyalists by name whose property was deemed permanently seized by the state. These same people were also permanently expelled from South Carolina. There was another subclass of loyalist sympathizers who were fined in an amount equal to about 12% of the value of their estates. With no loyalists in the legislature, and with public sentiment strongly against them, the assembly approved these measures overwhelmingly. A more controversial debate focused on slaves. Senator John Laurens had long supported the idea of arming slaves to fight and offering them their freedom in exchange for service. Those suggestions had been shot down pretty overwhelmingly in the past. This time, Laurens tried to push the idea into one that focused on the popular idea of confiscation from the Loyalists. He proposed that 2,500 slaves confiscated from Loyalist plantations be formed into regiments that would fight under white officers. The state was under an obligation to provide more soldiers to the Continental Army and didn't seem to have any chance of raising them from among the white population, since no patriots would lose slaves under this plan and because it would resolve the problem of raising more Continental regiments in South Carolina. Laurens hoped that it might be more palatable to the delegates. Unfortunately, there's no record of the legislative debate on the matter or the count of the final vote, only that the matter was debated and rejected. Several informal accounts indicate that the plan initially looked like it was going to pass. Several leaders, including Rutledge, had to lobby hard against the plan before it finally failed. That leaves us with the question, why did it fail? The seizures would have only impacted Loyalist slave owners, and the Patriots had already shown little concern for the property rights of Loyalists. Even so, providing arms to former slaves, and also ending up with a population of freed former slaves living in South Carolina after the war, was seen as a dangerous policy. Many expressed fear that these freed slaves, who were comfortable with combat after serving in the American Revolution, would form the core of a larger slave revolt within the state in the future. The other big slave debate during the session was over Sumter's policy of paying his militia with slaves seized from Loyalist plantations. This also proved controversial. Sumter, as you might guess, was a vocal supporter of a bill which authorized under law what he had already been doing. General Marion, however, became one of the leading opponents of the bill. The assembly ended up neither approving or disapproving of the practice, which, as I said, had already been in place for months. In fact, the assembly disbanded without coming to any decision on how to pay the state's soldiers. Some of the slaves seized from Loyalists under the Confiscation Act that was passed by the assembly would be used to pay Continental recruits. The assembly also voted to grant immunity from suit for all officers who had, in the past, and would continue to seize private property for public use. So although they didn't formally approve Sumter's policy of seizing slaves to pay his soldiers, they made sure that he couldn't be sued for doing so after the fact. The assembly adjourned on February 26th, after being in session for just over a month. Sumter ended up resigning his commission from the army after all this and retired. The assembly offered him a seat in the Continental Congress, but he also declined that. He would later return to politics, but his military career was over. Most of the other officers who had been elected and served in the legislature returned to their military duties following the assembly's adjournment. Now, in addition to Sumter's resignation, one other major departure around this time was that of Lieutenant Colonel Light Horse Harry Lee. General Greene had relied heavily on Lee's cavalry, particularly so after the capture of Colonel William Washington at Eutaw Springs. Lee had enjoyed relative independence and had been performing pretty actively up until this time. There seemed to be a number of things that contributed to his decision to resign his command on January 26, 1782, a little over a week after the South Carolina Assembly had just begun its session. Much of Lee's pique seemed to be centered around the arrival of John Laurens. Lee had been pushing hard for the attack on John's Island that I discussed last week. Greene had considered it too difficult to get across the island while the British still controlled the waters around it. Even so, he granted permission to attempt the raid based on Lee's persistence. Greene, however, directed Lee to share the command with John Laurens, who had seniority over Lee. Laurens, as I've said before, was more than just a lieutenant colonel. He was extremely well-connected to the elite families in South Carolina, as well as a favorite of General George Washington. Lee seemed to see Laurens's lust for glory as pushing him aside. Lee's resignation letter to Greene, and subsequent letters over the next few days as Greene attempted to get him to change his mind, indicated his level of frustration. Lee believed that he had received insufficient credit for his glorious deeds at Eutaw Springs. He also seemed to show frustration at Laurens's involvement in the attack on John's Island. After Greene determined that Laurens would take over Lee's legion after his departure, Lee also criticized that appointment. He told Greene that Laurens was not experienced enough and that he would, quote, waste the troops very fast. Although Greene attempted to get Lee to change his mind, the young lieutenant colonel seemed unwilling to reconsider. Once that became clear, Greene hoped to offer him at least a farewell party, but Lee also declined that. Greene then offered a letter of introduction to General Rochambeau, who was still with the French army at Williamsburg, Virginia. Greene hoped Lee would brief the general on the Southern campaign, perhaps with the hope that Rochambeau would eventually bring his soldiers to assist Greene's army in the South. Again, Lee declined doing even that, just wanting to go home. Lee ended up staying a few more weeks. His delay does not seem to be related to waiting for Laurens to complete his term in the assembly, or because of any hesitation in his decision to leave. It seemed more to have to do with the difficulty in obtaining a carriage to take him back to Virginia. Lee departed South Carolina in late February, only a few weeks after his 25th birthday. Aside from Laurens's new command, the other big change in the South was the arrival of the Pennsylvania line. In November of 1781, following the victory at Yorktown, General Washington deployed these reinforcements to Greene in South Carolina. He gave command of the reinforcements to Major General Arthur Sinclair. Now, we haven't heard much about Sinclair since he surrendered Fort Ticonderoga way back in 1777. At the time, Sinclair said that in surrendering the fort, he would destroy his reputation and military career. And he was right. Although exonerated after an inquiry, Sinclair never again got another field command during the war. He had remained an aide to George Washington. Everyone seemed to agree that Sinclair was a pretty decent administrator, but not ready for an independent field combat command. After Sinclair arrived in South Carolina in January of 1782, he served as second in command to General Greene, who was the more senior major general. In the end, Sinclair would only remain in the South for a few months during a period of relative inactivity. By summer, he would return to his home in Pennsylvania. Along with Sinclair, the Pennsylvania line came with another general, Brigadier Anthony Wayne. Most recently, Wayne and the Pennsylvania line had been fighting in Virginia under General Lafayette and, of course, participated in Yorktown. With Virginia secured and with Lafayette's decision to return to France, Wayne and his soldiers marched south. When they arrived in South Carolina, Greene kept most of the Pennsylvania line with him, near Charleston. But he sent General Wayne with a smaller force into Georgia. That state still faced brutal fights between Patriots and Loyalists. The British still maintained their garrison at Savannah with over 1,300 regulars and hundreds more Loyalist militia. They also had the support of local Creek and Cherokee tribes. Greene tasked Wayne with trying to restore peace in most of the state and specifically told him not to try to take Savannah. Greene stressed that prudence, not attempted acts of bravery that could result in disaster, were what were needed in the state. Wayne's instructions were to attempt to get the Loyalists to come around and accept Patriot rule, ending the continued bloodletting between neighbors. Wayne set up his forces along the Savannah River, about 25 miles north of the city of Savannah. His position cut off the British in the city from their Indian allies. Shortly after he got there, his army captured a Choctaw caravan on its way to bring supplies to the British in Savannah. Wayne kept a few of the chiefs as hostages, but allowed the rest to return home, telling him that the new leadership only wanted their peace and friendship, but that they could no longer support the British. Wayne also drafted a proclamation for the governor to issue a pardon to Tories who would end their opposition to Patriot rule. Now, despite Greene's calls for prudence, Wayne also began raiding outposts around Savannah, riding his troops to within a few miles of the city. In hopes of reining in Wayne's aggressive tactics, Greene refused to send him more ammunition and recalled some of the soldiers that he had initially sent with Wayne. Wayne's arrival in Georgia also coincided with the end of a political rift that was threatening to divide the Patriot leadership in Georgia. Now, you may recall a few episodes back how I recounted how a few Georgia delegates at the Continental Congress had appointed Nathan Brownson to be commander of all militia in Georgia. Brownson had almost no military credentials or experience. He was a physician by trade. The more experienced militia officers in the state strongly rejected Brownson's appointment, which was creating a crisis in the military leadership within the state. Despite not liking Brownson, the other big objection was that he was appointed by delegates to the Continental Congress, who really had no standing to appoint anyone to anything. General Greene eventually smoothed over the differences by getting the leaders to agree that Brownson would become governor of Georgia, while the experienced militia general John Twiggs would become the state's commander of militia. Now, this seemed to work for a time, until Governor Brownson learned that Twiggs was holding councils of war without informing him, and was working directly with Greene to receive supplies rather than going through the civil government. But once again, Greene tried to smooth things over by instructing Twiggs to keep Brownson in the loop and to forward supply requests through the civilian leadership in Georgia. A short time later, Brownson once again wrote Greene that Twiggs was reporting on recent skirmishes to Greene directly, but not providing military reports to the governor. Twiggs had told Brownson that Green had requested that he receive the reports on military actions directly. The governor dashed off another angry letter to Green that he took this as a personal insult, with Green leaving him out of the loop. General Twiggs was also upset that Brownson was not respecting his authority in military matters. So the governor of Georgia and the commander of the state were both offended by each other's actions and barely speaking to each other. Both of them were also mad at Green by this point for trying to work with the other. Fortunately for Green, the matter resolved itself. The Georgia legislature replaced Governor Brownson in January of 1782, selecting John Martin as the new governor. Under Martin, the Georgia legislature would take action similar to what was happening in South Carolina, things like naming hundreds of loyalists who would be banned from the state and have their property confiscated. Fighting in Georgia and South Carolina would continue. The British garrisons at Charleston and Savannah felt increasing pressure, but remained where they were through the spring of 1782. Green, as I said, received several reports that British reinforcements were on their way to change the situation, but none of those reports ever proved accurate. Both sides seemed to remain on hold, waiting for other events to impact what they would do next. Next week, we're going to take a look at how the wider war is spreading, as Spain captures British Menorca in the Mediterranean. This episode is supported by Factor. If you're not familiar, Factor is a food delivery service. It's spring now, and we all want to be spending more time outdoors enjoying life and not in the kitchen. Factor ensures you have fresh, never frozen, chef-crafted, dietitian-approved meals that you can prepare in just 2 minutes. Each week, you get a menu of 35 meal options, as well as 60 add-ons, including breakfasts, on-the-go lunches, snacks, and beverages. I got a few of the all-natural energy drinks, which were just great. You can customize your orders as much or as little as you want each week, and can pause or make changes at any time. They've even got a special deal for fans of the American Revolution podcast. Head to factormeals.com/ARP50 and use the code ARP50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code ARP50 at factormeals.com/ARP50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Hey, thanks for joining the American Revolution Podcast After Show, part of the Airwave Media Network. Thanks to my Patreon supporters in the Alexander Hamilton Club, George Davis, Mike Hager, John Celentano, Michael Mulhern, and the Sons of the American Revolution, who have their own podcast at fastfunhistory.com. Thanks also to Robert Morris Circle supporters, Anthony McGinnis, and Greg Pusak. I also want to thank Jonathan Rathje for a generous one-time contribution via Venmo. If you want to support this podcast but don't want to make an ongoing commitment through Patreon, I happily accept gifts via PayPal and Venmo. There are links on my blog and website. I know they say this all the time, and you're probably sick of hearing it, but your donations do make this podcast possible, and I am so grateful for your support. I also want to remind everyone of our next roundtable event on April 10th, 2024. I hope to have several people working on plans for the 250th celebration joining us to discuss those preparations. If you want to participate with us via Zoom, make sure to get on my mailing list so that I can send you a notice with a Zoom link. To get on my mailing list, go to my blog or website and click on the link for the mailing list. Now, this week, we looked at the return of legislatures in South Carolina and Georgia. This really marks the beginning of the post-Yorktown era, where we see an end to large battles. At the same time, civilian governments are struggling to preserve order and decide how to move their states forward. We also said goodbye this week to John Rutledge's wartime service. He would, of course, go on to other things. He would later represent South Carolina at the Constitutional Convention and serve as a justice of the Supreme Court, and even a chief justice for a very short time. Like many Southerners of this era, his views on slavery were, let's say, complicated. I noted in the main show that he was a leading opponent of John Lawrence's effort to turn slaves into soldiers. Also, during the Constitutional Convention, he was an outspoken voice to prevent any efforts to end slavery in the Constitution. Despite these actions, Rutledge did express a dislike of slavery during his lifetime, and he did seem to take the common view that the institution would have to end at some time. He got rid of most of his slaves later in life, and his wife, Elizabeth Grimke Rutledge, manumitted all of her slaves. The daughters of his wife's cousin were Sarah and Angelina Grimke, who became the most famous well-known abolitionists in South Carolina before the Civil War. We also said goodbye this week to Light Horse Harry Lee. After returning home to Virginia, he married his cousin and started a family. He later served in the Confederation Congress and in the Virginia Assembly, and would go on to become governor of Virginia in the 1790s. At George Washington's funeral, he eulogized the general with the term first in war, first in peace, first in the hearts of his countrymen. Later in life, Lee had some problems. He remained a staunch supporter of the Federalist Party in a state that increasingly opposed that party, as his fellow Virginians, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, led the Democratic-Republican Party. Lee's opposition to the War of 1812 resulted in him being beaten nearly to death by a pro-war mob in Baltimore. After that, he left the United States to recuperate in the Caribbean, and he died before he could ever return. A few years before he left Virginia for the last time, he and his second wife had an eighth son, who also became known for his military service, Robert E. Lee. I want to preface my book recommendation this week by saying that the books I relied on for this week's episode are all books that I've already recommended. Most of them were biographies of those who were involved in these events, and I also particularly used John Buchanan's book, The Road to Charleston. Since I've recommended those books already, my selection this week is another book that covers the region during the war, but really doesn't have much to offer on the specifics of what I discussed this week. The book is Voices of the American Revolution in the Carolinas by Ed Southern. It's a relatively short book that covers the revolution in North and South Carolina. It's a pretty easy read if you're interested in an overview of the war in the Deep South. First published in 2009, there's a paper and a Kindle copy, and there's also a borrow-only copy of the book on archive.org if you just want to take a look at it. It uses some extensive first-hand accounts, including a lot of letters and other primary sources, and puts them together in a convenient way. If that sounds interesting, check out Voices of the American Revolution in the Carolinas. My online recommendation is another older book in the public domain. It's actually a published PhD thesis entitled History of Elections in the American Colonies. The author is Cortland Bishop. His PhD thesis was published in 1893 as part of a larger series by Columbia College, what we today call Columbia University. It's an interesting overview at how elections worked in the colonial era. If that interests you, I've included direct links, as always, on my blog and website so that you can access this book on archive.org. My question this week asks, did soldiers really wear three-cornered hats in the Revolution? The short answer is yes, some of them did. At the time, these hats were known as cocked hats. The term tricorn, which became much more popular later, did not come into use to describe them until the late 1800s, long after the hats had fallen out of style. The style itself, though, was pretty popular throughout the 1700s. Before that, you had a wide-brimmed hat with a much taller crown as being more the style. Look at pictures of pilgrims or soldiers in the English Civil War for examples of that older hat. The histories of the tricorn hat seem to trace back to Spanish soldiers who had begun wearing them in the mid-1600s. The fashion later spread to French soldiers. By the end of the 1600s, they'd become quite popular with civilians as well. There are portraits of King Louis XIV wearing them in the late 1600s. There's some speculation on the reasons for the change in fashion. Some historians point out that the shorter crown on the tricorn made it better for a gentleman to show off his wig. Also, it made it easier to tuck the hat under one's arm when going indoors. Some of the really early cocked hats are only cocked on one side, which some believe made it easier to shoulder arms without knocking the hat off your head. There's also speculation that the cocking on one side turned on to cocking on both sides, since people at the time were obsessed with symmetry. That is, having both sides of things look the same. You see it not only in fashion, but also in a lot of the gardening and architecture of the time. If you ever visit Independence Hall, you'll notice that there's a door on the back which leads to another room, and there's a door on the other side which leads nowhere. The reason? They wanted a door on each side to give the room symmetry. Pinning up the hats on both sides, or cocking it, as it was called, gave the hat this symmetrical look. It also prevented the wide brim from flopping around and looking sloppy. Men still wanted wide brims at times, so you could have that brim to keep you dry when you were outside in the rain. But cocking it kept those wide brims out of the way when not needed. Many paintings throughout the 1700s show men of all social ranks and station wearing cocked hats. Perhaps outside of the Revolution, we're most familiar with these hats on pirates. It was the style for many decades. Of course, there are examples of other hats being worn at this time. Many frontiersmen wore uncocked wide-brim hats, and some soldiers wore tall helmets. Most notably in the Revolution, the Hessians did this. Beginning in the 1780s, these cocked hats started to fall out of style, slowly giving way to the tall, shorter-brimmed top hat that eventually evolved into ones like the one Abraham Lincoln famously wore. Another military style that was popular by the War of 1812 was a hat that was cocked on only two sides. It could be worn so that the two sides were either sticking out on the front and back or sticking out on the right and left. Take a look at some portraits of Napoleon or other soldiers from that era for some good examples of that. But as I said, by 1800, the three-cornered hat was decidedly out of fashion. There were still some old men who clung to their old out-of-fashion hats, much like older people today, I guess, still tend to cling to fashions that were more popular when they were younger. One of the most notable was James Monroe, who wore a cocked hat while president in the 1820s. And this practice actually got him the nickname, the Last Cocked Hat. If you have a question that you'd like me to answer, please reach out to me, either via email or on Twitter, Facebook, Quora, or Reddit. Well, that's all for this week. I hope you will join me again next week for another American Revolution podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.